This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister says termination of the Saudi-led coalition siege of Yemen is necessary for the continuation of the existing truce. Hundreds of protesters in the city of Cologne demand Germany stop supporting Ukraine and drop sanctions it has imposed on Moscow. Also, at least 10 people are killed in a stabbing spree in the Canadian province of Saskatchewan. Police say the two suspects are still at large. Hello, welcome. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran's foreign minister says the current truce holding in Yemen wholly depends on the Saudi-led coalition ending its siege of the impoverished country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting with the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg. He said Yemen's stability and security has a direct impact on the stability and security of the entire region, including the Persian Gulf. Amir Abdullahian pointed out that the final decision-makers on the future of Yemen are the people of that country. The UN-sponsored truce in Yemen came into effect in April and was renewed in June. It has been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war and has endured despite multiple violations from the Saudi side. Yemen's oil ministry has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to shed light on the looting of Yemeni crude oil by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. It says Riyadh and its allies continue to block Yemeni fuel ships and steal the country's oil, despite a UN-brokered truce. More in this report by Abdulatif Al-Washali.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN-brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al-Masila, at a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemenis suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN-brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations.
As Yemenis face a fuel crunch due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israel is set to approve the construction of 2 new settlements comprising more than 3,400 shelter units in the occupied West Bank over the next week. The Palestine Liberation Organization's Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission has disclosed the Israeli plan. It says the regime is considering new settlements on the eastern outskirts of the occupied city of Al-Quds. The head of the commission says some 2,000 Palestinians, including Bedouin communities, are at the risk of forced displacement, which amounts to a war crime. All Israeli settlements on the occupied territories are illegal under international laws. The UN Security Council has time and again condemned Israel's settlement expansions and called on the regime to put an end to such activities. Saad Nimr is a professor of political science at Brzezinski University. He says Palestinians have the legal right to react to the Israeli atrocities. Have a listen.
We have to react to the Israeli atrocities because the Israelis, they don't understand but one language, which is violence versus violence. In the case of violence, then they will be more cautious and they will be more even thinking about whatever they are doing in the West Bank. But once there is no reaction at all and nobody is doing anything, definitely they will escalate and more escalation of their atrocities against Al-Aqsa Mosque, against Jerusalem, and against the rest of the occupied West Bank. So definitely this is a kind of a natural reaction by the Palestinians to resist this occupation. Plus, what are these soldiers doing in our land? They are occupiers, and definitely, by definition, then we have the right to defend our land and to resist these soldiers and these occupiers in any way we find it appropriate. So definitely, our reaction or the Palestinian reaction is absolutely not only in place, but I would say also it was a little bit too late. We need even more than that.
Hundreds of staff working for American tech giants Google and Amazon are going to stage vigils outside the headquarters of the two firms in protest at a controversial deal with Israel. The vigils are set to be held on September 8th in the cities of San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. The employees' protests are part of a movement known as No Tech for Apartheid and want to prevent Israel from using technology in its crimes against Palestinians. The movement, which was founded last year, has started a campaign to sign a petition against a deal worth over $1 billion. So far, 40,000 Americans have signed the petition. The movement says the deal, known as the Project of Nimbus, would enable the apartheid Israeli regime to escalate surveillance of the Palestinians. Google and Amazon would provide Israel with cloud storage services and artificial intelligence tools under the contract. Thousands of mostly Russian-speaking anti-war protesters have marched through the western German city of Cologne, demanding Berlin stop supporting Ukraine. The demonstrators also called on the German government to drop sanctions it has imposed on Russia over its military operation against Ukraine. The rally, organized by Russian diaspora groups in the city, was met by a few dozen counter-protesters who had gathered to express support for Ukraine. The protest rallies come as Germany, like many other countries in Europe, is grappling with an energy crisis after Russia shut down its gas supplies to the continent. The German government has approved a 65 billion euro plan to ease pressure on households and businesses amid dwindling supplies and soaring energy bills. The Ukrainian president has told Europeans to expect a difficult winter as his country's war with Russia has led to cuts in oil and gas exports by Moscow. Volodymyr Zelensky claims Russia is preparing a decisive energy blow to all Europeans for this winter. He made the comments after Moscow shut down a main pipeline that supplies Russian gas to the continent. Moscow has cited Western sanctions imposed over its war with Ukraine and technical issues for energy disruptions. European countries backing Kiev with diplomatic and military support have accused Russia of weaponizing energy supplies. This comes as European leaders are struggling to ease the impact of high energy prices. G7 countries have already announced a planned price cap on Russian oil exports. The Kremlin says it will stop selling oil to any country that implements the cap. The Ukrainian Prime Minister says his country expects around $5 billion in financial aid from the European Union in the coming days. Denis Shmyhal said that the funding package would help Kiev shore up its economy. He said the financial aid will be spent on Ukraine's military as well. Shmyhal, who is now paying a visit to Germany, also said that Europe's largest economy will send sophisticated air defense systems to Ukraine this autumn. Germany has so far supplied Ukraine with heavy arms such as howitzer tanks or Mars rocket. Since the beginning of the Ukraine war, the country has repeatedly demanded the EU and the US ramp up their support. Remote Canadian communities are shaken by a stabbing rampage. At least 10 people are killed and many more injured in multiple attacks in Saskatchewan province near the border with the United States.
At this point in our investigation, we have located 10 deceased individuals in 13 locations in the community of James Smith Cree Nation and Weldon, Saskatchewan.
Police say they have located deceased individuals in 13 locations. They say 15 of those injured have so far been transferred to hospitals. Some of the victims are said to have been targeted while others were randomly attacked. The suspects are still at large. The intention behind the stabbing attack is not known yet. The police have issued emergency alert all across Saskatchewan and adjoining Alberta and Manitoba provinces. A manhunt has been launched for two suspects. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the mass stabbing as, quote, horrific and heartbreaking. The United States' history of occupation and intervention in Latin America spans almost 200 years. U.S. has been present in countries from the north of the continent in one way or another to achieve its own goals. But now the latest U.S. attempts to intervene in Cuba's affairs have drawn a backlash from officials there.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers like the USSR at the time, leading them in getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path. U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo, it's a State Department memo that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as the wording is actually as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
U.S. President Joe Biden's funding of millions of dollars to opposition groups is just one of Washington's strategies to topple governments in Latin America. According to one source, there have been 41 U.S. interventions in one form or another in Latin American countries. One country where the U.S. has heavily but abortively pushed for regime change is Venezuela.
Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido launched a botched coup to oust democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. The attempted coup, which came with the green light off and support of Washington, is yet another example of Washington's intentions with Latin America. The U.S. has even imposed several rounds of sanctions against Venezuela aimed at ousting Maduro and replacing him with Guaido. The sanctions, which include the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan assets abroad and an economic blockade, have caused poverty, a lack of access to basic goods, gasoline shortages, and power cuts. But despite all this, the U.S. seems to have failed in its foreign policy regarding not only Venezuela, but Latin America as a whole, where most of the recently elected presidents have already expressed their ambitions of distancing themselves from the U.S. and establishing stronger ties among themselves.
And, you know, you're not asking this, but there is a new international realignment, and partly I think it's because of these blockades, because of the unilateral action by the United States against countries that are developing to impose its own financial rule on other countries. The United States needs to learn that other countries have a right to determine their own form of government, that their own way of living, that the people in those countries have that right without the United States putting them into debt, without sanctioning them, without creating hardships, and without military attack.
The latest turn of events is also an indication of the U.S.'s failed sanctions policy. Venezuela has, despite the sanctions, managed to double its oil production recently thanks to Iran's help. Iran itself, which is also heavily sanctioned by Washington, is also a prime example of the U.S.'s failed policies, as it has managed to withstand the economic pressure while gradually finding ways around them.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Significance of knowledge-based production in Iran's economy. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has named the current Iranian year 1401, corresponding to 2022, as the year of production, knowledge-based manufacturing, and job creation. Please stay with us for more. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has chosen production and manufacturing as the key phrase in at least five of the mottos and slogans that he chose to name various years recently. On other occasions, production and manufacturing was certainly implied or indirectly referred to in the chosen motto. For example, 2018 was designated as the year of supporting Iranian goods and commodities. Certainly, the motto implies support for Iran's production and manufacturing sector. Thus, the leader of the Islamic Revolution regards production and manufacturing as the most important way to counter the economic war that is being waged against the Islamic Republic by our enemies. Industrialized nations have invariably focused on manufacturing and production in their chosen paths to economic success. The Norwegian economist Erik S. Reinert, in his book How Rich Countries Got Rich and Why Poor Countries Stay Poor, says quite clearly that all rich industrialized countries, today and in the past few centuries, possess a powerful and high-quality manufacturing sector. This is the key to creation of wealth. Undoubtedly, production and manufacturing has been a key element of wealth creation in all industrialized nations, such as Britain in the 19th century, the United States, Germany and Japan, and the former Soviet Union in the 20th century, and in more recent years, in countries such as South Korea, Taiwan and China. Another important point to note is that manufacturing and production is the key to reducing unemployment. Most jobs are connected either directly or indirectly to the manufacturing sector. In 2005, the manufacturing sector accounted for 20.2% of Japan's economy, 23.2% of Germany's economy, and 13.4% of the US economy. If the relative size of the manufacturing sector in the United States was as large as it is in Germany, this would have meant an extra 10 million well-paid and high-quality jobs for American workers. If the relative size of the US manufacturing sector was as large as it is in Japan, this would have meant an extra 7 million high-quality jobs for American workers. Another important point to note is that a thriving manufacturing sector means more money in the pockets of workers and less pressure on ordinary people. By imposing tough sanctions against Iran, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution have tried to cause a rift between the government and the people of Iran by increasing inflation and reducing ordinary people's purchasing power. A thriving manufacturing sector, however, creating more jobs, is the perfect antidote to this foreign economic venom. A thriving manufacturing sector translates into less economic pressure on ordinary people. Furthermore, trade between nations is based upon manufacturing and production, and not services. Although the service sector is also significant economically, manufacturing is more important. The current Iranian government, known as the 13th government, has decided to boost trade with all of Iran's neighbors. A key plank of Iran's foreign policy is to strengthen relations with neighboring countries and to increase trade with neighboring states. This year's motto, the Year of Production, Knowledge-Based Manufacturing and Job Creation, places a lot of emphasis on knowledge-based production and knowledge-based manufacturing. The leader has said, "In order for the economy to grow and to achieve economic reform, we must move decisively towards a knowledge-based economy." But what is a knowledge-based economy? A precise and succinct answer is that in a knowledge-based economy, advanced science and technology plays a very important role in all aspects of manufacturing and production. The knowledge economy is an economic system in which the production of goods and services is based principally on knowledge-intensive activities that contribute to advancement in technical and scientific innovation. A knowledge-based economy features a highly skilled workforce within the microeconomic and macroeconomic environment. Institutions and industries create jobs that demand specialized skills in order to meet the global market needs. Knowledge is viewed as an additional input to labor and to capital. Thus, a knowledge-based economy reduces the costs of manufacturing and production and increases efficiency and productivity. Goods and commodities produced in a knowledge-based economy are of a higher quality and are able to compete in the global market. Manufactured goods in such an economy are competitive globally and have excellent quality. Under conditions where the Islamic Republic of Iran faces sanctions and economic pressure from the outside, it makes sense to go for knowledge-based manufacturing in this country. This will undoubtedly reduce pressure from the outside and make sanctions ineffective. Rather than selling raw materials with little or no added value, we must use high technology and innovation to manufacture high quality and high added value products, creating wealth and earning hard currencies. A knowledge-based economy makes us more competitive. It improves our trade balance with the rest of the world and gives us soft power as well. Well, dear listeners, we have come to the end of this program. Goodbye and God bless.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the honor of being joined by my brothers, Brother Habib and Brother Ali. Salaam alaikum, gentlemen.
Wa alaikum salaam.
Wa alaikum salaam wa rahmatullah.
So there's, because the events of Ashura and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, note the word, the fact that I chose the word movement, not anything else.
Thank you very much.
The movement of Imam al-Hussein and the event of Karbala, it's so multifaceted and it's so dynamic. And it's so full of life, like 1400 years later, and people are still deriving so many messages and are developing deeper understandings of the things that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did. I feel like because of that, there's still a lot of concepts therein that we need to clarify, right? And perhaps one of the questions that a lot of people, I happen to know a lot of people have, is that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam rose against the tyrant of his time to fight for what he believed in and to defend the religion of God, right? How is that different from some of the current Tekfiri groups that claim to be doing the same? We're fighting the corrupt system or whatever it is, even if it's the world system that exists in the 21st century, and we're fighting for our beliefs, and anyone else that comes and stands in our way, we're going to fight them too. I know exactly what Brother Habib's answer to this is going to be, so I'm going to move to Brother Ali. Yes. Please, could you clarify this for us, and how exactly do the two types of fighting differ?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Definitely, we know that resistance and muqawama and standing in front of oppression and tyranny and tyrants of the time was something or a lesson that we took from the Imam Hussein's uprising. That is, standing in front of a tyrant, and also for the sake of iqama. Iqama means actually establishment of the justice. This is the mission of all the prophets and even their deputies in the course of history till today. That inshallah we are hoping for the arrival of Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, to inshallah help us to reach to the last establishment of iqama of justice on the scene of the earth. So this is what we have learned, and everyone learns from the event of Ashura and the conduct and seerah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But those takfir groups that you refer to, actually, let's study and check and analyze their actions and their reactions in today's world and see if they are really following Imam Hussein or not. This is what we have to check. The takfiris that we have seen in their news has come up in different media, in Iraq, in Sham, in Afghanistan. We haven't seen them to stand in front of, let's say, an oppression or a tyrant. Rather, whatever we have seen beheading Muslims, beheading brothers and sisters in faith, and killing from among Muslims. We haven't seen them standing in front of, for example, let's say, a regime like Israel, who is the representative of Kufr, right? So what we have seen from their actions is just to create fitna inside the Islamic Ummah. When, for example, in Iraq a couple of years back, in one night they beheaded 1,700 students.
Yeah,
1,700 students of University of Musa.
All of them were younger than 25 years old.
Right. So does it mean that they are really standing in front of a tyranny and oppression, or did they come to help the, let's say, Islamic Ummah to take the lesson from Imam Hussein alayhi salam? So exactly, this is what Imam Hussein stood for. And in fact, Imam Hussein came to stand in front of this ignorance, this jahl, this pure ignorance that actually can be seen in the personality and the actions of these people, the same actions that has been actually narrated in the behavior of Khawarij or Kharijid.
Exactly.
Right? So these takfir or extremist groups that we see in the Islamic Ummah, they in no way can be following Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the culture that Imam Hussein alayhi salam wanted to spread. Imam Hussein wanted to tell us to learn how to be, to understanding the Imam of the time, to be aware of the time that you are in, to be well aware and to be in
woke, if it's a good translation.
To have insight, right?
Exactly. To have insight of the time that you are in. To know who is your imam, to keep your self-esteem, to stand in front of Taghut, to seek martyrdom, but with enlightenment. Mm-hmm. This martyrdom, those actually extremist groups that are trying to kill themselves with, I don't know, different kinds of bombs. And among Islamic among Islamic communities, does it mean the lesson that they have taken from Imam Hussein al-Islam? No way. We cannot.
But then
a lot
of people can just look at the event and say Ashura was nothing but a political crusade, Muslims fighting Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly.
Because a lot of people are still radiallahu anh killed radiallahu anh. Mm-hmm. It was all a big mistake and confusion.
Look, yeah, some say that both groups actually did the ijtihad and they did ijtihadu akhtau.
So that ironic, is
they did the ijtihad and they made mistake, and for a mujtahid, he actually is going to be rewarded.
Yeah.
But do you think, have you ever thought that ijtihad in front of nas is totally invalid? Ijtihad in front of nas. Nas is already
nas
there. Imam Hussein, Imam of the Ummah.
The scripture, right?
Yeah, the scripture, the religion, the acknowledged religion.
Mm.
All of those people who were in front of Imam Hussein, they knew him, that he is the grandson of the Prophet. And they know his status in front of the Holy Prophet, in the eyes of the Holy Prophet.
Mm.
They heard about the hadith that the Prophet, a couple of years back, said about Hassan and Hussein.
Mm. And they he deliberately stated them as well.
And Jabir ibn Abdul Ansari was already there, and he heard the narration that even he introduced.
In his lecture during the on the ground of Karbala, on the 10th day of Muharram, he told them, I am not, the Prophet has not told you that I am Sayyidina Shabab al-Jannah. He told them to go ask this narrator, that narrator, this companion, that companion that are still alive.
Mm.
Go and ask them and see if I'm telling the truth or not.
This is very simple-minded, Sheikh, to think that, okay, they did the ijtihad and the other group did the ijtihad. I mean, they did their analysis. They reached to this final conclusion that they have to kill each other, but both of them will be in Jannah. This
when someone wants to place doubts, when someone wants to place doubts, they could create doubts.
Exactly, because it was the same narrative about Jamal, wasn't it?
About what? Jamal, the same thing as well, yes. Mm-hmm. But the thing about Jamal is that the Ummah went into like 16 different teams. There's this book called the Jamal, Sheikh al-Mufid, radhuanullah ta'ala alayh. At the beginning of the book, about 82 pages about it, are just the different teams and sects and their theories about al-Jamal. Who was right?
Mm-hmm.
This team was right, that team was right. And Sheikh al-Mufid was pretty much looking at the Mu'tazilis, because the Mu'tazilis were the most Sunni sect available at the time, especially during Baghdad, because Sheikh al-Mufid lived in Baghdad. And yes, there is this fitna. And one of the questions that I always ask my Sunni brothers is that, if you were available on the day of Jamal, which team would you
party?
Pick? Which team would you pick?
Yeah.
And if you leave Amir al-Mu'mineen, al-Haqq ma'ali wa ali ma'al-Haqq.
Yeah.
If you leave the other side, you know, their companions, their wives of the Prophet, and very difficult to choose. Yeah. So which one would you choose?
It's a tricky
Who was
situation.
The Imam of the time?
That's the thing.
All the quarrel is on this issue.
Could
you guys translate that, please?
Whoever dies not knowing the Imam of his time, the leader of his time, dies a death
of ignorance.
Pre-Islamic ignorance.
All right, so there's two questions that I have here. Number one is regarding what you said, Brother Ali, that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam rose to establish justice, right?
Mm.
That's understandable because it was his responsibility as divine leader, right, to establish justice. And the question, however, I have is that he set off, he got killed. What justice was established?
Mm-hmm.
What rights did he gain for anyone anywhere?
And
I mean, even after
can I
that,
add to her question and
the Ahlul Bayt were under even more pressure.
Yeah. Medina was attacked by Yazid.
Exactly,
after
the Kaaba
of
was burned down.
The Kaaba was burned down. People still, the saying that's available. وَارْتَدَّ النَّاسِ عَنِ الدِّينِ إِلَّا ثَلَاثَ بَعْدَ مَقْتَلِ الْحُسَيْنِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. And then they state the three companions of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. So where was the justice?
That's a good question. If I want to answer it through the stories and events of the dawn of Islam, Sadr al-Islam, it might not be that much actually tangible. But let me make it more tangible and close to understanding. Look, some believe that in case they kill General Soleimani, they will actually put off the activities of Quds, IRGC Quds army, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what happened?
Mm-hmm.
Did it make them more united and make the whole country, not only Iranians?
People who are criticizing the group that you stated were also available during the funeral and the events and everything. And you felt that the people were together for the first time in a long time.
But then what happened
afterwards? Not only Iranians. Iraqis. You might
actually the biggest in the world history.
Yeah.
The biggest, as in across regions. Mm-hmm. You know, Shahid Soleimani is.
Yeah.
I get that. Awesome. Then what?
Right. So by killing a person and thinking that you have put up everything and you have actually closed it down and nothing comes up. So it's quite wrong understanding.
Are you saying that it had long-term
effects? So this blood, actually, this is the blood that is flourishing, that it comes up and actually this gives life to the Islamic Ummah.
Through generations.
Yeah, to think that, okay, yes, physically speaking, yeah, Hussein was defeated.
Yeah.
But what is Yazid now and what is Hussein? What is the status of Yazid in the Islamic Ummah? So, let me tell you some quotes from Islamic scholars about Yazid.
Before that, can I just bring up this quote of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam that pretty much answers your question? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, when he entered Medina after Karbala, people were sending their condolences and telling him, Azam Allah Ajrak, and they were praying for him, you know, trying to
console him.
Yeah, console him and whatnot. A man came who was happy with what happened to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, who said, who won? He asked him, who won? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam replied, when the adhan comes up, you will know who won. This is a very deep statement. And of course, I don't say it's the reason of Mu'mvat of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but I say that it's one of the benefits that happened because of the killing of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that the religion remained, that Yazid has no power to do with Muawiyah what Muawiyah did, that propaganda that Muawiyah had, which was pretty much to wear the dress of Islam and state that we are Islam, we are the representatives of Islam. Yazid has no power to do that anymore because of the movement of Imam Hussein.
By killing Imam al-Hussein, Yazid dug his own grave. Inshallah ta'ala, if there are any other points that you guys want to continue, we can pick it up in further episodes of the show. Thank you so very much for being with us. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allahumma ja'al mahya ya mahya Muhammad wa al Muhammad wa mamati mamata Muhammad وآل محمد
نور حسين يلف forever in our hearts and in our minds
نور حسين يلف forever
in our hearts and in our minds I swear to Allah and to my Allah
I swear to Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were killed thirsty, oh Hussein.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The notorious Guantanamo Bay prison is an ample proof that the United States is a terrorist regime. Reports of torture and violation of human rights in this infamous prison is indicative of the fact that the U.S. is the biggest sponsor of state terrorism. If the United States wants to counter terrorism, instead of waging endless wars around the world and causing civilian deaths and destruction, it should start from itself. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. The title of this article is Guantanamo Proof of U.S. Being a Terrorist Regime. Stay with us, please. The website of Crescent International has recently wrote, given the degree of ignorance among most Americans, it is safe to assume that many would not know what Guantanamo Bay represents or where it is located. Even if they knew, most would not care. After all, their heads have been stuffed with such vile propaganda about the threat of terrorism that they have come to believe those held there deserve what to be punished. Opened in January 2002, a few months after 9/11 attacks, at its peak it held 779 prisoners. They were the worst of the worst. In the infamous words of Donald Rumsfeld, "Worms have probably consumed his stinking body by now as he awaits his rightful place in the lowest depth of hell." But more than 20 years after it was opened, Guantanamo Bay still holds 36 detainees as of July 25th, 2022. Only a handful, less than 10 men, are charged with involvement in 9/11 attacks, but their trials have not been held even at the Kangaroo Military Tribunal. Most of the rest are either cleared for release or await judgment on their release. They have not been charged with any crime. Guantanamo represents American lawlessness at its worst. According to the United Nations, such detentions have always triggered controversies over legality. Not only does the U.S. illegally occupy Cuban territory, but most detainees have not been tried according to U.S. laws. Further, international human rights organizations have not been allowed to visit the facility, again in clear violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions. 2 days after he was sworn in as President of the United States in January 2009, Barack Obama signed the 13,492 executive order. It was titled Review and Disposition of Individuals Detained at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base and Closure of Detention Facilities. Its intended aim was to close the torture camp permanently. During his 8 years in office, Obama was able to reduce the number of detainees from 277 in 2008 to 91 in 2016, but he was unable to close it. American generals threatened him with dire consequences if he closed Guantanamo Bay. Even Joe Biden, who served as Obama's vice president, vowed to close the torture camp, but it still remains open. Away from the prying eyes of journalists as well as human rights organizations, American soldiers and CIA agents have inflicted horrific torture on innocent people. Euphemistically called enhanced interrogation technique, torture was widespread. Sleep deprivation, holding detainees in stressful positions, and other forms of barbaric practices were routinely inflicted on the detainees. Their only crime was to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. To get a glimpse into what the detainees suffered, a few examples would suffice. Omar Khadr, captured in eastern Afghanistan in July 2002, he was shot twice in the chest by American occupation troops and barely survived. He was moved to Bagram Air Base, which served as America's first torture location. While his wounds were still raw, Khadr, 15 at the time, was subjected to brutal torture. In October 2002, he was chained to the floor of a U.S. transport plane in extremely stressful position and shipped to Guantanamo Bay. His real torture began there because he was accused of being an Al-Qaeda child. Every soldier took turns to inflict their own punishment on him. Even the Canadian government, led by the racist Stephen Harper at the time, joined in inflicting harm on him. Had it not been for Khadr, lawyers Dennis Edney and Nate Whitling, he would still be languishing in Guantanamo. Brought to Canada in 2012 under a plea bargain, Khadr won his release in 2015 and received $10.5 million in compensation from the Canadian government in 2017 for violating his charter rights. He was guilty of nothing. He was the victim of American barbarism, aided and abetted by the likes of Harper and his right-wing anti-Muslim bigots. And we have other examples, including Saifullah Paracha. The 74-year-old Pakistani businessman was captured in Thailand in 2003 and brought to Guantanamo in September 2004. He was accused of being an Al-Qaeda facilitator because he had exchanged money for two of the alleged hijackers that he did not know. Would a grocery store owner be charged if the alleged hijackers had brought groceries there? Pracha was cleared for release last year after his son, Ozair, also accused of terrorism, had his charges thrown out by a New York judge in March 2020. Allegations against Ozair as well as his father were based on confessions extracted under torture from detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The son was sent to his native Pakistan. The elderly Pracha, suffering from multiple ailments, has still not been released, even though the review board declared that he was no longer a threat to the U.S. He never was. And Abu Zubaydah was subjected to the most brutal forms of torture. He was captured in August 2002 by FBI, CIA, and General Pervez Musharraf intelligence agents in Faisalabad. Abu Zubaydah was accused of a laundry list of terrorist acts. Donald Rumsfeld said he was, if not the number two, very close to the number two person in Al-Qaeda. The Central Intelligence Agency informed Assistant Attorney General Jay Bai that he served as Osama bin Laden's senior lieutenant. In that capacity, he has managed a network of training camps. He also acted as Al-Qaeda coordinator of external contacts and foreign communications. CIA Director Michael Hayden would tell the press in 2008 that 25% of all the information his agency had gathered about Al-Qaeda from human sources originated with one other detainee and him. George W. Bush would use his case to justify the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, claiming that he had run a terrorist camp in Afghanistan where some of the 9/11 hijackers trained and that he helped smuggle al-Qaeda leaders out of Afghanistan so they would not be captured by U.S. military forces. But as Rebecca Gordon exposes in her brilliant article in Counterpunch, none of it was true. During the operation to capture him, Abu Zubaydah was severely injured, shot in the thigh and stomach. Without immediate medical attention, he would have died, but the CIA wanted him alive, so it flew in an American surgeon to patch him up. The agency's concern was not humanitarian. The CIA wanted him alive to be able to interrogate him, hoping to extract information from him. Ms. Gordon reveals that Abu Zubaydah had the dubious luck to be the subject of a number of CIA firsts. The first post-9/11 prisoner to be waterboarded, the first to be experimented on by psychologists working as CIA contractors, one of the first of the agency's ghost prisoners, detainees hidden from the world, including International Committee of the Red Cross, which under the Geneva Conventions must be allowed access to every prisoner of war, and one of the first prisoners to be cited in a memo written by Jay Bybee for the Bush administration on what the CIA could legally do to a detainee without supposedly violating U.S. federal laws against torture. While he was accused of all kinds of misdemeanors, his real crime was that in 1980s, he helped run the Khaldun camp. This was a training facility set up in Afghanistan with CIA help during the Soviet occupation of that country. In other words, Abu Zubaydah was like Osama bin Laden, an American ally in the fight against the Soviets. Abu Zubaydah's horrific torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, slamming against a concrete wall, reflects the true nature of American elite. They are the real terrorists. If there were any justice in the world, American officials involved in authorizing such horrific torture would be put on trial and publicly executed.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.